In 2005, he built a 35-story Trump Tower in White Plains, New York. He pursued licensing his name to a Trump Tower development in Tampa, but it never got off the ground. Trump made plans to build what became Trump Tower Chicago, a 98-story condo hotel tower. In Hawaii, he licensed his name to the Trump International Hotel Waikiki. In Las Vegas, a 64-story Trump International Hotel was on the drawing board, and his name was in play with Bayrock for a tower in Phoenix. As usual, his clientele had had its share of run-ins with the law. In Florida, at least 13 buyers of Trump Towers condos in Sunny Isles Beach had been the subjects of government investigations, either personally or through their companies, including members of a Russian-American organized crime gang, the Miami Herald reported. When interviewed about the Sunny Isles condos, Trump Organization lawyer Alan Garten stated that it was completely unfair and completely misleading to suggest we had anything to do with those people, and called shady buyers an industry-wide problem for luxury real estate. But the larger point is that in these ways and more, Donald Trump was bigger than ever. When it came to having fun, Trump's partners spared no expense. Tevfik Arif flew Bayrock employees out to the Rixos Hotel in Antalya, Turkey, for an all-inclusive vacation. On another occasion, both Arif and Alexander Mashkevich rented the Savarona, a 446-foot yacht that had once been owned by the father of the Turks, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. For a week-long party in September 2010, when Mashkevich rented the yacht, nine young escort girls were allegedly supplied for businessmen attending the party on the Savarona. One of the businessmen was especially fond of 13 to 14-year-old girls, and the organization head supplied those girls, according to documents that were part of an investigation. A search by police, the report said, turned up a huge amount of contraceptives and a file with escort girls' pictures and hotel receipts. 10 suspects, among them two Turkish billionaires, were arrested immediately and investigated for solicitation and trafficking in women. Mashkevich and Arif denied the accusations against them, and in April 2011, Arif was acquitted of all charges. The court judgment also recorded that all women aboard the yacht were over 18. According to Mashkevich's lawyer, Ronel Fisher, Turkish authorities made no claims against Mashkevich, nor was he interrogated by police. A spokesman told the British daily, The Telegraph, that he was on board the yacht when it was raided, but he was not in any way connected to criminal or immoral acts on it. Nevertheless, the indictment paints a salacious picture of a sordid and extraordinarily decadent world of spectacular yachts, Mediterranean villas, and private planes, in which billionaire oligarchs ship in batches of teenage girls and trade human beings to have sex with their wealthy friends, while their underlings wrangle over whether to pay top dollar for a virginal 16-year-old and the bother of having to send that unpretty back. The level of decadence was unparalleled. Every oligarch had to have a yacht, each one bigger than the next. And who among them could be the most transgressive? Tamir Sapir won notoriety for furnishing his yacht with bar stools covered in python skin, a stuffed lion, and the carcasses of 29 different endangered species. Sapir agreed to pay $150,000 for violations of the Endangered Species Act. As the New York Post put it, it was just like Noah's Ark, except everything was dead and illegal. Bayrock never seemed short of funding, but much of it came from murky origins. In the 90s, Arif had worked in Kazakhstan for the UK-based Trans World Group, a company run by David and Simon Rubin and the Chernoy brothers, all big players in the highly lucrative but spectacularly dangerous metals industry, which was beset by aluminum wars that left dozens of executives, traders, bankers, and mob bosses dead. Similarly, Alexander Mashkevich and his partners in the trio, who may have been investors, did business with Mikhail Chernoy and had huge holdings in chromium, alumina, and gas operations in Kazakhstan. When it came to having ties to the Kremlin, Tamir Sapir had high-level connections through Rotem Rosen, his son-in-law and the CEO of the Sapir Organization. Rosen was also a lieutenant of Israeli diamond magnate Lev Leviev, who was a major donor to the Putin-supported Chabad sect and had been close to Putin since the early 90s. Given that his control over the oligarchs was crucial to maintaining power, Putin needed to be able to keep tabs on their whereabouts and where their money went. If hundreds of millions of dollars from the Russian mafia or other forms of flight capital were funding a Trump-branded project, Putin wanted to know. If oligarchs were buying scores of Trump condos in Soho or Panama or Toronto, Putin wanted to know. And Bayrock would have had the answers. Indeed, in many ways, Bayrock resembled an updated version of the initiative launched by KGB General Vladimir Kruchkov at the end of the Cold War, when the KGB had founded scores of front companies that appeared to be self-sufficient independent corporations but were staffed by operatives tied to the KGB and the GRU. Far more than merely providing phony identities as cover for intelligence operatives, these companies were meant to be multi-billion dollar corporations that would trade the natural resources of the former Soviet Union on the global market, make billions of dollars, and simultaneously launder money, gather intelligence, and grow through relations with Western partners and Western banks. One of the models for those companies was Boris Bichstein's Sibeco SA. Over the years, Bichstein, who hosted the famous Tel Aviv meeting with Mogilevich, had worked with Colonel Leonid Veselovsky, an intelligence operative who specialized in starting front companies for the KGB all over the world, in Antwerp, Toronto, Winnipeg, Panama, Zurich, and Delaware. Along the way, through the Soviet Foreign Ministry, Bichstein also met and began working with Patok Shodiev and Alexander Mashkevich, who comprised two-thirds of Eurasian Natural Resources Corporation's trio. He also had ties to Solntsevo head Sergei Mikhailov, with whom he started a business in Antwerp called MAB International. Bichstein seemed to have followed the dictates of the KGB under Kruchkov's guidelines to set up enterprises abroad, but it was unclear how successful this initiative was. Colonel Veselovsky himself maintained that most of the ideas for shifting communist assets overseas never got beyond the planning stage. Regardless, many of the apparatchiks chosen by the KGB went ahead and launched their careers as independent businessmen. Moreover, Bichstein understood the importance of having mutually beneficial relationships with strategically placed bureaucrats. And so it was that Bichstein hired Veselovsky and introduced him to the world of private jets, immense limousines, and extravagant mansions. In 1991 and 1992 alone, Sibeco gave birth to at least six highly profitable joint ventures and went on to create many more all over the world. "You shouldn't think that people like Bichstein and Veselovsky are financial geniuses," Sergei Sokolov, a journalist for Komsomolskaya Pravda, told the Washington Post. "What mattered in the old days and what matters now is personal connections." And so, a decade later, those connections resurfaced in ventures tied to Trump. In the early 2000s, Alexander Schneider, a former Sibeco executive who was Bichstein's son-in-law, began to develop the tallest building in Canada, the 65-story Trump Tower and Hotel in Toronto. When it came to financing the skyscraper, Schneider, a billionaire of Russian extraction, turned to Raiffeisen Bank International AG in Vienna, a bank whose affiliate has been called a front to provide legitimacy to the gas company U.S.-indicted Russian crime boss Semyon Mogilevich controls, Rosenergo. according to Scott F. Kilner, Deputy Chief of Mission for the U.S. Embassy in Austria. So it followed that it was likely that funds from the Mogilevich-Firtash money pipeline were behind the Trump project in Toronto. In addition, the Wall Street Journal reported, Vnešin Konombank, or VEB, at the time, bought $850 million of stock in a Ukrainian steelmaker from Schneider, about $15 million of which went into the Trump-Toronto project. At the time, the chairman of VEB's supervisory board was Vladimir Putin. Later, Simon Zucker, Schneider's lawyer and the initial source of that information, changed his statement and said he was not able to confirm that VEB funds went into the project. Trump was never a partner, Zucker told Business Insider. He never had an equity interest. We licensed his name, and there was a contract for him to manage the hotel. Once again, an arrangement in which Trump was merely licensing his name was used to exculpate him. Nevertheless, the VEB deal did go through, and Trump did collect fees from the project. Schneider did not respond to messages left for him. 4 years after the building was finished in 2012, it went into receivership due to poor sales. Trump's name was later removed from the building. Trump fostered similar relationships all over the world. In 2003, Trump had whetted Latin American interest in the Trump brand by staging the Miss Universe pageant in Panama City, Panama. 3 years later, he struck a deal in Panama to develop the Trump Ocean Club International Hotel and Tower, a sail-shaped 70-story waterfront complex that included residential apartments and a casino. According to an investigation by Global Witness, an anti-corruption watchdog, Trump was entitled to a licensing fee, 1% of any financing he secured, and a cut of every unit sold, all of which would add up to more than $75 million. Many of the problems behind the project led to a man named Alexandre Ventura Nogueira, the tower's primary broker. According to a report by Reuters, Nogueira, who with his partners sold more than half the apartments in the project, marketed the condos largely to Russians because, a colleague said, Russians like to show off. For them, Trump was the Bentley of real estate brands. But the Reuters investigation also found Nogueira did business with a Colombian who was later convicted of money laundering, a Russian investor in the Trump project who was jailed in Israel in the 1990s for kidnapping and death threats, and a Ukrainian investor who was arrested for alleged people smuggling while working with Nogueira and later convicted by a Kiev court. In addition, Reuters reported, he was alleged to have either failed to pass on all the deposits he collected to the project's developers, or sometimes sold the same apartment to more than one client, with the result that, on completion of the project, some clients had no clear claim on a property. Nogueira said that half of his buyers were Russian, and that some were allegedly part of the Russian mafia. According to conversations secretly recorded by a former business partner, in 2013, Nogueira said he had laundered tens of millions of dollars through real estate. More important than the money from real estate was being able to launder the drug money. There were much larger amounts involved, he said in the recording. When I was in Panama, I was regularly laundering money for more than a dozen companies. Nogueira told Reuters that he became the leading broker for the project, thanks in part to the support of Trump's daughter, Ivanka, who appeared in a promotional video with him. The Trump Organization went into overdrive with the new model. Why not? Since Trump did none of the financing and almost none of the development, its risks were minimal and the upside was high. The Trump Organization's role in the Panama Project was at all times limited to licensing its brand and providing management services, said Alan Garten, the company's chief legal officer. As the company was not the owner or developer, it had no involvement in the sale of any units at the property. No one at the Trump Organization, including the Trump family, has any recollection of ever meeting or speaking with this individual, Nogueira. Similarly, one Trump-branded project after another was beset by corruption, lawsuits, and the like. In Baku, Azerbaijan, The New Yorker reported, Trump licensed Trump Tower Baku to close relatives of Zia Mamadov, a transportation minister who was described in a diplomatic cable as notoriously corrupt, even for Azerbaijan. Now, Trump licensing projects got underway all over the world, from White Plains, New York, to Kolkata and Pune, India, from Vancouver to Washington to Jersey City and more, which did not necessarily mean that they did well. Though it was almost completed, Trump Tower Baku never opened. Likewise, one after another, Trump Tower projects were launched and then either canceled or never completed. In Fort Lauderdale, Tampa, Charlotte, Phoenix, New Orleans, Dubai, Rio, Stuttgart, Tel Aviv, Baja, and more. In the face of such chaos, most organizations would fail or be forced to change their approach, but not Trump's operation. In fact, what would become Trump's most significant new real estate ventures were being hatched on the 24th floor of New York's original Trump Tower, where Felix Sater had taken charge of Bayrock and had his sights set on Russia. Chapter 14. Moth, Flame. During his years in Moscow, former CIA agent John Cypher, who worked undercover in the U.S. Embassy, heard all about businesses like Boris Bishstein's Sibeco and came to the conclusion that the United States had absolutely nothing like them. Both the KGB and CIA had long staffed embassies with undercover operatives as a standard practice. In addition, the CIA also provided non-official cover for operatives such as Valerie Plame, whose association with the agency was famously leaked to the press by the George W. Bush administration. However, such cover was largely limited to providing false identities, in Plame's case that she was an energy trader in Brussels. But, Cypher told me, launching actual profit-making companies like Sibeco was a different story entirely. It's very hard for us in the West to distill the idea that you also have a cloudy group of people with ties to the Kremlin who have intelligence training and who have made a bunch of money that can support intelligence operations, he said. Those of us who worked in the American embassy in Moscow, we instinctively stayed away from it because it was dirty. We knew there was an overlap of crime and assassinations and surveillance and money in Cyprus and real estate in London. If Bayrock was a latter-day version of Sibeco, getting to the heart of it meant dealing with Felix Sater, its most visible, charismatic, and authoritative presence. He has a talent for drawing people in, said Bayrock's former finance director Jody Criss, who later sued the company, alleging that it was covertly mob-owned and operated. Criss's suit claimed that Bayrock had defrauded Criss and another Bayrock employee and never intended to honor promised payments. The real purpose of the company, it said, in addition to marketing expensive condos, was to launder millions of dollars and evade taxes. Bayrock contested Criss's claims and described him as a disgruntled employee. The case was later settled on undisclosed terms. Felix knew how to be charming, and he knew how to be brutally nasty, said Criss. He has charm and charisma, but that's what con men do. On the one hand, that meant Felix could out-Trump America's most famous real estate magnate and convince him that he, Felix Sater, had an opportunity no one could possibly pass up. How did I get to Donald? Sater asked. I walked in his door and told him, I'm going to be the biggest developer in New York, and you want to be my partner. On the other, Felix was also the kind of guy who threatened to attach live-wired electrodes to the testicles of a colleague, cut off his legs, and leave him dead in the trunk of a car, as Sater allegedly promised a business associate in Arizona. Robert Wolf, Sater's lawyer, denies these allegations and stated that the claim that Sater had threatened violence was an outright fabrication. Which was the real Felix Sater? His work with Bayrock as a partner of Trump's, and later his work on behalf of Trump himself, raised a number of unanswered questions. Sater's biggest project at Bayrock was the troubled Trump Soho, the 46-story, $450 million hotel condominium in downtown Manhattan that was beset by one lawsuit after another. In November 2017, the Trump Organization announced that it was going to end its affiliation with the Trump Soho by the end of the year. The building was subsequently renamed the Dominic. From the start, the mere fact that Sater was a principal in Bayrock created a very serious quandary, as it was trying to raise $1 billion for Trump Soho and other projects. Sater was a twice-convicted felon. No banks would lend to Bayrock if they knew about Sater's convictions. In fact, when Trump Soho got underway, Sater began spelling his name S-A-T-T-E-R, as he told the Times, to distance himself from a past and to throw off anyone searching his name on Google. Another complication was the fact that Sater was also a cooperator with the FBI and other federal agencies. As a result, he had an immunity deal and, he later asserted, was still carrying out various daring missions for the CIA, the DIA, and the FBI, such as helping the FBI investigate scams run by the Italian mafia on Wall Street. For his help, Sater was given extraordinary latitude by the FBI, so much that Frederick Oberlander, an attorney who represented Jody Kriss in his lawsuit against Bayrock, and other attorneys and journalists, sometimes referred to Felix as another Whitey Bulger. Bulger, who had been the crime boss of the Winter Hill Gang in Boston, became an FBI cooperator and used his immunity as cover for an ongoing crime spree. He was later convicted of involvement in 11 murders. All of which raised the question of whether Felix, like Bulger, was using his immunity as a cover to launder money through real estate for the Russian mafia. At the very least, it seemed, Sater had a double life. He was a felon, but he was working undercover for America's Secret Services. That much was clearly established. But what if he was really working for the Russians? What if he really had a triple life? The answers were difficult to find, in part because the records of Sater's convictions had been sealed as a result of his immunity deal. No one seemed to know the whole story about Sater, especially Donald Trump. That became clear later when Trump gave a deposition in a court case filed against him, Bayrock, and several other parties, and was asked under oath about working with Sater. First, an attorney showed Trump a copy of a December 17, 2007 story in the New York Times, headlined, "Real Estate Executive with Hand in Trump Projects Rose from Tangled Past," and asked if he was familiar with it. "Very vaguely," Trump replied. "Long time ago. I just vaguely remember the article, but we weren't dealing much with him." How many times had Trump conversed with Sater? "Over the years?" Trump asked. "Not many. If he were sitting in the room right now, I really wouldn't know what he looked like. If he would call, I'd take his call because he was representing Bayrock." "You should ask those questions to Bayrock. He worked for Bayrock. He didn't work for me." Trump was obviously perturbed by the line of questioning, but his testimony was crystal clear about Sater. He barely knew the guy, or so he said. Yet there was plenty of evidence to the contrary. In the beginning, Sater and Tevfik Arif had been thrilled to be situated on the 24th floor of Trump Tower precisely because residents on the upper floors had to get off at the 24th floor landing and change elevators to reach street level. That made it easy for Felix to bump into Trump accidentally and pitch him new projects, and he took full advantage of their proximity. Others at Bayrock talked to Trump on occasion, but it was a relationship that Felix jealously kept to himself, with considerable success. Once they got to know each other, Felix thought nothing of going up a flight of stairs to Trump's office to chat about business ideas. Just me and him. After returning from a trip to Russia, Sater said, he'd come back, pop his head into Mr. Trump's office and tell him, you know, moving forward on the Moscow deal. In 2005, when Trump flew to Colorado to give a motivational speech, he and Melania brought Felix with them. Trump and Sater were interviewed and photographed together in Denver and Loveland, Colorado, Phoenix, Fort Lauderdale, and New York. A former colleague of Sater's told Politico, Trump called Felix like every other day to his office. They were definitely in contact always. They spoke on the phone all the time. And they occasionally dined together at a restaurant in Manhattan's meatpacking district called Kiss and Fly, with what New York Magazine described as a quasi-Roman bathhouse feel for its young, rich, and overwhelmingly European patrons. Back in Trump Tower, as an inducement for Donald to drop by their 24th floor offices, Felix became so fixated on the appearance of female employees that the firm was referred to as Babe Rock. Taking the bait one day in 2006, Trump ran into Bayrock secretary Rachel Crooks, then 22, on the elevator landing, who introduced herself and then saw him go into action. He took hold of my hand and held me in place like this, Crooks said. He started kissing me on one cheek, then the other cheek. He was talking to me in between kisses, asking where I was from or if I wanted to be a model. He wouldn't let go of my hand, and then he went right in and started kissing me on the lips. Crooks has since joined several other women in demanding a congressional investigation into Trump's alleged sexual misconduct. Meanwhile, Trump entrusted Felix with accompanying his children to Moscow to work on Trump projects in the Russian capital. On one of the trips, Felix took Ivanka on a tour of the Kremlin, and later said he arranged for her to sit in Vladimir Putin's chair. It would be bizarre for him to take her into the president's personal office, presumably while the president was absent, unless Putin and his security service advisors knew about it and viewed the relationship with the Trumps as worth developing, Daniel Treisman, a UCLA political science professor and an expert on Russian politics, told Business Insider. The Trumps began spending more and more time in Russia. Starting in 2006, Donald Jr., executive vice president of development and acquisitions for the Trump Organization, made about half a dozen trips to Russia over the course of a year and a half. In terms of high-end product influx into the U.S., Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets, he later told a Manhattan real estate conference. We see a lot of money pouring in from Russia. Trump himself said he was looking forward to the realization of a major project in Moscow. We will be in Moscow at some point, he said in a deposition. He added that he had met with Russian investors at Trump Tower to pursue the Moscow deal and that Donald Jr. was working on it. As for Felix Sater's role, Trump said nothing. In fact, Alan Garten, the Trump Organization's general counsel, later asserted to Forbes that Sater's presence in Moscow while Ivanka and Donald Jr. were there was merely a coincidence. As Donald Jr. saw it, the stumbling block in Russia was corruption. Several buyers have been attracted to our projects there, he told a trade publication. It is definitely not an issue of being able to find a deal, but an issue of will I ever see my money back out of that deal, or can I actually trust the person I am doing the deal with? As much as we want to take our business over there, Russia is just a different world. It really is a scary place. Of course, how scary Moscow was depended on what kind of company you kept. In addition to his work for Trump, in 2007, Sater began working as an advisor to real estate oligarch Sergei Polonsky, a flamboyant, long-haired, 6-foot-4 billionaire developer whose company, Mirax Group, had been making a name for itself in Moscow. Polonsky had won both fame and notoriety for a number of reasons, the former for developing Moscow's 97-story Federation Tower, which for several years was the tallest building in Europe, and the latter for becoming an icon of excess, who declared, "Anyone without $1 billion should fuck off." In 2008, Polonsky spoke at a real estate conference in Moscow at which Donald Trump Jr. was the keynote speaker. Since then, Polonsky was convicted of fraud in 2017, after having been charged with stealing 3.2 billion rubles, about $51 million. He and other principals at Mirax, including two board members and its board president, Maxim Temnikov, fled Russia and were being sought for allegedly appropriating 2.4 billion rubles, about $39 million, from a Moscow real estate development. Sater wasn't exactly a big hit with everyone at Mirax. "You can't trust him in any way, not in a professional setting, not in a personal setting," Mirax's chairman of the board, Alexei Kunitsin, told The Atlantic. "You could see it very clearly. He was telling constant crazy stories, wild fantasies about all the people he knew. He was not a balanced dude. He's very emotional and gets into conflicts very easily." Nevertheless, Sater had begun to forge ties in the treacherous world of Russian business. Polonsky and Mirax had had an extended working relationship with Moscow Mayor Yuri Lushkov and had partnered with the Mogilevich-linked company Sistema. In addition, Sater joined with Maxim Temnikov to buy a $4.8 million condo in affluent Fisher Island, Florida. Exactly how much Trump knew about Sater and the inner workings of Bayrock was unclear, which is exactly the way he seemed to want it. But on December 19, 2007, Trump gave a deposition in a lawsuit he filed against author Timothy O'Brien. 2 days earlier, New York Times reporter Charles Bagley had revealed that Felix Sater had a hidden past, and now that Trump was under oath, it was possible to determine the extent of his knowledge. When asked about Sater's criminal history, Trump testified, "I'm looking into it because I wasn't happy with the story, so I'm looking into it." In other words, under oath, Trump had admitted that he knew about Sater's run-ins with the law. Because the deposition was marked confidential and kept under seal, Trump may not have expected it to become public. Regardless, Trump's knowledge of Sater's past was now a matter of court record. According to Jonathan Weiner, the former money-laundering czar in the Clinton administration, if someone in Trump's situation failed to investigate such allegations, he would be open to charges of willful blindness in terms of the knowledge he had. The responsible course of action would have been to have Sater resign and disclose Sater's past to interested parties, says Richard Lerner, who, with Frederick Oberlander, filed a quitam lawsuit against Bayrock in 2015, that is a civil suit that rewards private entities working to recover funds for the government. In this case, they charged Bayrock with laundering $250 million in profits from Trump's Soho and other projects, and setting up elaborate mechanisms to evade more than $100 million in state and federal taxes. Sater's attorney, Robert Wolf, characterized the allegations of their extortionate litigations as baseless and highly defamatory. But rather than extricate himself from the deal with Bayrock and a partnership with a convicted felon, Trump kept silent about Felix, continued working with Bayrock, and ultimately profited from the arrangement. Indeed, according to Bayrock's internal emails, rather than disclose the truth, Trump even saw the predicament as an occasion to renegotiate his fees. Upward, of course. "Donald saw an opportunity to try and get development fees for himself," Sater emailed investors a few days after the deposition. In the end, Sater remained managing director of Bayrock through 2008. Trump also continued to participate in the venture and enjoy its profits. "Inducing a bank to lend money based on a fraudulent loan application, i.e. concealing Sater's criminal past, is bank fraud," said Fred Oberlander. If you know that the loans were procured by fraud, yet stay involved, it's a conspiracy to violate money laundering and racketeering statutes. It's certainly a question for Special Counsel Robert Mueller to look into, said Jonathan Weiner. What anyone in Trump's position should have done is investigate those allegations about Sater's criminal past to ensure that there was not a money laundering operation. But Trump wasn't charged with any crime at the time. Nevertheless, once condos in the building were finally put up for sale, the project suffered more than its share of problems. The building's no-man's-land neighborhood, not really Soho, with its grand entrance beside Varick Street and the chaotic approach to the Holland Tunnel, made it a difficult sell. In addition, in order to circumvent restrictive zoning laws, the project was explicitly marketed to prospective buyers overseas as a second or third home, with the highly challenging proviso that owners could live in their apartments only 120 days a year and never for more than 29 consecutive days in any 36-day period. In 2010, 15 condo buyers filed suit, charging the Trumps and Bayrock with an ongoing pattern of fraudulent misrepresentations and deceptive sales practices. According to the Daily Beast, among the claims made to spur sales were Ivanka Trump's proclamations to Reuters and to the London Times in June 2008 that 60% of the 391 units in the building had been sold. Documents later submitted to the New York Attorney General showed that only 15% had found buyers. The suit was eventually settled, and the plaintiffs received 90% of their deposits back. But in 2014, 4 years after its opening, more than two-thirds of the building's condos remained unsold. The website Curbed headlined a story, "Trump Soho Heads to Foreclosure Due to Unsellable Condos." As other lawsuits unfolded, more charges about Bayrock came forth. Among them, allegations that the condos themselves were being used as vehicles for money laundering. According to the Financial Times, lawyers for Almaty, the biggest city in Kazakhstan, charged that Viktor Krapunov, a former Kazakh energy minister and the city's ex-mayor, and his family conspired to systematically loot hundreds of millions of dollars of public assets and to launder their ill-gotten gains through a complex web of bank accounts and shell companies, particularly in the United States. Krapunov and Mukhtar Ablyazov, another Kazakh oligarch, have been accused of embezzling about $10 billion from a Kazakh bank and laundering it through shell companies, which purchased real estate all over the world. With regard to Trump Soho, the lawyers charged that Krapunov's network used dozens of shell companies, among them three limited liability companies, whose ownership could be easily concealed, called Soho 3310, Soho 3311, and Soho 3203, which corresponded to apartments of the same name in Trump Soho. The vendor of the apartments was Bayrock Sapir LLC, which was named after the developers of the building, Bayrock and Tamir Sapir's Sapir Organization. The Financial Times also reported that, according to regulatory filings, Bayrock Sapir had a third co-owner, Donald J. Trump. In response, Jan Lawrence Hanslick, an attorney for Krapunov, issued a statement saying, "These allegations are more than a decade old. For 7 years, ending in 2004, Viktor served with honor and distinction as administrator or Akim of Almaty, a political subdivision of the Nazarbayev government. He then served as Nazarbayev's administrator of the East Kazakh region until 2007. It was then that Viktor had a political falling out with the Nazarbayev regime. Since then, Viktor has been relentlessly pursued by the regime, which has sought to discredit him in the eyes of the Kazakh people. Now persona non grata in their own country, Viktor and his family look forward to refuting these old allegations in a fair public trial in a country that guarantees justice to those who come before its courts." Initially, Sater had helped the Krapunov family buy apartments in Trump Soho, but he later turned on the family and began cooperating with lawyers and private investigators who were pursuing multiple cases against them on three continents. According to the New York Daily News, Sater pocketed at least $21.5 million from related deals with Krapunov and Mukhtar Ablyazov. Sater's lawyer, Robert Wolf, denied that Sater ever worked with Ablyazov or that he knew whether or not Ablyazov was involved in any wrongdoing. The Oberlander and Lerner lawsuit alleged Bayrock's projected profits were to be laundered untaxed through a sham Delaware entity to the FL Group, Iceland's largest private investment fund, the first major firm to collapse in 2008 when Iceland's financial bubble burst, and a favored financial instrument for loans to Russia-connected oligarchs who were, court papers claim, in favor with Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin has denied that Putin has any connection to the FL Group or Bayrock. According to Bloomberg, Eva Joly, who assisted Iceland's special prosecutor in the investigation of the financial collapse, said, "There was a huge amount of money that came into these banks that wasn't entirely explained by central bank lending. Only mafia-like groups fill a gap like that." But Iceland was only one of Bayrock's many connections to Russian money, Russian intelligence services, and the Russian mob. In the Soviet era, Arif had spent 17 years working for the USSR Chamber of Commerce and Industry, an agency run by KGB officers that had long been systematically engaged in commercial espionage in the West. As for Alexander Mashkevich and Patok Chodiev, who were named in Bayrock's promotional material, both had worked for Boris Bechstein's KGB-linked Sibeko, and were allegedly tied up with the Russian mafia through their alliance with the Chornois in the aluminum wars. In the early 2000s, Mashkevich, Jodiev, and Alijan Ibragimov were accused of money laundering in Belgium, where prosecutors believed their funds to be of criminal origin. In the end, however, the cases were settled, with the trio paying a fine to the Belgian government and not admitting their guilt. Another significant Bayrock partner, the Sapir organization, had, through its principal, Tamir Sapir, a long business relationship with Semyon Kislin, the commodities trader who was tied to the Chernoy brothers, and according to the FBI, to Vyacheslav Ivankov's gang in Brighton Beach. A generous donor to former New York mayor and future Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani, Kislin happened to have considerable political capital after Giuliani appointed him to be a member of the New York City Economic Development Corporation. At a 1999 press conference, Kislin denied any ties to the Russian mob, insisting, "I have done nothing evil." Kislin did not respond to an email request for comment. In his attempt to win influence, Kislin's donations were not partisan, and he contributed to Democrats as well, including New York Senator Chuck Schumer. In addition to being wired into the Kremlin, Sapir's son-in-law, Rotem Rosen, was a supporter of Chabad along with Sater, Sapir, and others at Bayrock, and as a result, was part of an extraordinarily powerful channel between Trump and Putin. After all, the ascent of Chabad in Russia had been part of Putin's plan to replace older Jewish institutions in Russia with corresponding organizations that were loyal to him. When they began, Russia already had a chief rabbi, Adolf Shayevich, who was recognized as such by the Russian Jewish Congress. But when Abramovich and Leviev installed Chabad Rabbi Lazar at the head of their rival organization, the Federation of Jewish Communities of Russia, the Kremlin recognized Lazar as Russia's head rabbi and removed Shayevich from its Religious Affairs Council. Consequently, the Federation of Jewish Communities of Russia, the voice of Chabad in Russia, became so close to Putin that he even made a point of attending the dedication of their center in Moscow's Marina Rosha neighborhood in 2001. With Chabad's Rabbi Beryl Lazar leading the way, the Federation of Jewish Communities of Russia was now providing Putin with a Jewish umbrella that allowed him to battle Vladimir Gusinsky, whose media properties had become critical of him, and who even dared to back candidates opposed to Putin. "I said openly," Lazar said, "that what Gusinsky was doing was not desirable and would hurt the Jewish community." But another reason for the close ties between Chabad and Putin was that both Lazar and Leviev had promised Putin that they would make their connections available to the Kremlin and open doors to the corridors of power in Washington. At the time, Trump's comeback in real estate and his ascent in TV were in full swing, but his political prospects were still dicey at best. However, his role in Bayrock and its real estate deals with Russian oligarchs were real and provided a connection to Moscow. That's what made the Chabad channel so mysterious. First and foremost, the biggest contributor to Chabad in the world was Leviev, the billionaire King of Diamonds, who had a direct line to Rabbi Beryl Lazar, a.k.a. Putin's rabbi, to Donald Trump, and to Putin himself, dating back to the Russian leader's early days in St. Petersburg. Leviev would make major real estate transactions with Jared Kushner, including selling the retail space in the former New York Times building to Kushner for $295 million. As an undergraduate at Harvard, Jared had been active at the campus Chabad House at Harvard. Jared later married Ivanka Trump and became a senior advisor to her father in the White House. Jared and Ivanka were also close to Chabad donor Roman Abramovich and his wife, Dasha Zhukova. Another major contributor was Jared's father, Charles Kushner, an American real estate developer who was eventually jailed for illegal campaign contributions, tax evasion, and witness tampering. But that is just the beginning of Chabad's ties to Trump. Indeed, one of the biggest contributors to Chabad of Port Washington, Long Island, was Bayrock founder Tevfik Arif, a Kazakh-born Turk with a Muslim name who was not Jewish, but nonetheless won entry into its high circle as a top donor. The Port Washington founder and head rabbi, Shalom Paltiel, happened to be an acolyte of Rabbi Beryl Lazar, Paltiel's dear friend and mentor, as he referred to Lazar. But he was also close to Felix Sater, and later named Sater Man of the Year for Chabad of Port Washington. At the ceremony honoring Sater, Paltiel recalled how Sater recounted his daring adventures as an intelligence operative. "I only recently told Felix I really didn't believe most of it," Paltiel said. "I thought perhaps he watched too many James Bond movies, read one too many Tom Clancy novels. Anyone who knows Felix knows that he can tell a good story. I simply did not put too much credence to them." In addition to Sater, Daniel Ridloff, a fellow Bayrock employee, was a member of the Port Washington Chabad House. Chabad supporters Rotem Rosen and his bride, Zina Sapir, of course were tied to Bayrock through Zina's father, Tamir Sapir, and they were such close personal friends of Trump that he let them have their 2007 wedding at Trump's Mar-a-Lago, with Lionel Richie and the Pussycat Dolls performing. A few months later, Leviev met with Trump in Moscow to discuss potential deals for Trump in Russia. Then, in June 2008, after Zina and Rotem's son was born, Lev Leviev arranged for the bris, the Jewish ritual of circumcision, to take place at the grave of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the renowned Hasidic rabbi who was the spiritual leader of the Chabad-Lubavitch movement. Touting the event as the best bris invite ever, New York Magazine opined that the invite list for this particular penis chopping was as chic as it gets, including hotelier Andre Balash, restaurateur Giuseppe Cipriani, New York nightlife empress Amy Sacco, various real estate moguls, and of course, Donald Trump and his future son-in-law, Jared Kushner. In the midst of these efforts, something took place that seemed entirely unrelated to Trump's interactions with Russia, but ended up creating one of the most significant links of all between him and the Kremlin. In 2006, a group of apartment owners at Trump World Tower, his 72-story skyscraper overlooking the United Nations, had taken control of the condo board and were accusing Trump of financial impropriety. For help, Trump turned to a sympathetic condo owner named Michael D. Cohen, who was such a devotee of the Trump brand that he had bought a number of Trump apartments himself and had his parents, his in-laws, and a business partner buy apartments in Trump World Tower. Cohen was the same Michael Cohen who knew Felix Sater when he was growing up in Brighton Beach. Initially, when Sater was first asked about his ties to Cohen, he downplayed their relationship. "Cohen wasn't one of my close friends," Sater told Talking Points Memo in 2017. "Just a guy dating a girl in the neighborhood, and we had a bunch of mutual friends." Later, however, on MSNBC, Sater referred to Cohen as an old and dear friend, which was likely closer to the truth. His suburban roots notwithstanding, Cohen had his own ties to the wise guys of Brighton Beach. Most notably, through his uncle, Dr. Morton Levine, there was his family's shared ownership of Brooklyn's El Carib Country Club catering hall, the well-known hangout for both Russian and Italian gangsters. According to the New York Times, Dr. Levine was a family practitioner, and one of the families for whom he provided medical services was the Lucchese crime family. In the process of providing those services, according to a sworn affidavit in 1993 from an FBI special agent, Dr. Levine aided their illegal activities. The affidavit added that a Lucchese underboss, Anthony Gaspipe Casso, regarded Levine as someone who would do anything for him. In addition to having served as headquarters for Evsey Agron and his gangsters, El Carib was where John Gotti held his Christmas party in 1988, when he was at the height of his power as head of the Gambino family. Among other notable mob festivities at the restaurant, Genovese crime family soldier Ernest Butch Montevecchi, who partnered with Felix Sater's father, Michael Shefirovsky, hosted a reception at El Carib for a mob subordinate who happened to be the nephew of Charles Lucky Luciano. But El Carib was just the beginning of Cohen's mob ties. After college, Cohen got a law degree from the Thomas M. Cooley Law School, now known as Western Michigan University Cooley Law School, at the time a notorious diploma mill, which, according to Reuters, has been repeatedly sued for misrepresenting employment and salary data about its graduates. In addition, Cohen got involved in an offshore casino business in Florida based on a 196-foot yacht, the Atlantic, a failed gambling operation, as BuzzFeed described it, that allegedly did not pay its debts and did business with people tied to accused and convicted criminals in both the Italian and Russian mobs. The casino was managed by Tatiana Varzar, the owner of the eponymous Russian nightclub in Brighton Beach, and her husband, Michael Varzar, who had been sent to prison for his role in the gasoline tax scam in the 90s. Representative Peter King, a Republican congressman from New York's 2nd District, observed that Cohen had cultivated a tough guy pose, that is, a main part of who he is. He talks about it. He likes to play up the act that he's a guy who was not raised in Manhattan. "I'm from Long Island. We don't take crap from anyone." According to an investigation of Cohen by ProPublica, after law school, Cohen worked with a series of small firms that defended clients accused of participation in various medical malpractice scams, phony auto accident cons, and the like, that were similar to Russian mafia swindles in the 80s and 90s. One of his first jobs after law school was working for a personal injury lawyer named Melvin J. Estrin, who pleaded guilty to bribing insurance adjusters to inflate damage estimates. He subsequently drew up incorporation papers for a number of dubious medical practices and medical billing companies. one of which had filed nearly 300 lawsuits. In one of the clinics, Cohen Incorporated, the principal doctor pled guilty to writing phony prescriptions that allowed clients to get 100,000 pills they ordinarily would not have been able to obtain. In 1994, Cohen had married Laura Schusterman, daughter of Fema Schusterman, a taxi entrepreneur who had pleaded guilty to defrauding the IRS. Meanwhile, Cohen's younger brother, Brian, had also married a Ukrainian woman, and Brian's father-in-law, Alex Ordonov, was seeking investors for an ethanol business Ordonov co-owned with Viktor Topolov, an oligarch whose associates were allegedly tied to the Ukrainian and Russian criminal underworlds. Topolov, according to Talking Point's memo, had a one or two steps removed relationship with Russian underworld kingpin Semyon Mogilevich. According to the FBI, Topolov's conglomerate, Kiev Donbas, employed three executives who were part of the Russian mafia, including one enforcer who was tied to Mogilevich and admitted to taking part in at least 20 murders. In New York, Cohen followed his father-in-law, Fema Schusterman, into the taxi medallion business, where they registered more than 15 companies, Sir Michael Hacking Corp., Lady Laura Hacking Corp., Smoochie Cab Corporation, and ended up working with Simon Garber and Evgeny Friedman, two Soviet-born New York taxi barons who managed part of Cohen's fleet. By 2003, he claimed he controlled a fleet of 200 cabs. Before the advent of Uber and similar services, taxi medallions sometimes sold for more than $1 million. Cohen associated himself with the most reckless and greedy players in the industry, said Baravi Desai, the executive director of the Taxi Workers Alliance, a group that represents cab drivers. They have simultaneously worked to inflate the value of their medallions and rip off their drivers. In 1999, Cohen received a check for $350,000 that was written by star hockey player Vladimir Malakhov. Under a sworn deposition, Cohen said he did not recall receiving the check and did not know why Malakhov might have paid him that sum. According to an article on Gordon, a Ukrainian news site, by Russian-American historian Yuri Felshtinsky, who co-authored Blowing Up Russia with Alexander Litvinenko, the $350,000 was intended for one of the leaders of the Izmailovskaya Organized Crime Group, OCG, one of the oldest and most important mafia gangs in Moscow. When Cohen was deposed and asked under oath if the signature endorsing the check was his, he replied, "I don't know, but it could be." Then, asked why someone would have sent him the check, Cohen said, "I have no idea." In the end, the Felshtinsky article concluded that the money was intended for one of the leaders of the OCG, Vitaly Yurievich Vuslaev, who was allegedly one of the gang's five kingpins. Gregory Ehrlich, a one-time friend of Cohen's who is now estranged from him, invited Cohen to his wedding, and according to the Wall Street Journal, overheard Cohen bragging that he belonged to the Russian mob. Ehrlich later said he did not believe Cohen had any such ties. Meanwhile, Cohen assembled a mini real estate empire of his own, part of which involved his and his family's buying up numerous Trump apartment units, with his Ukrainian father-in-law buying at least four units and Cohen buying five. According to Rolling Stone, during a five-year period, Cohen and people close to him bought $17.3 million in Trump properties. In February 2007, Trump complimented Cohen on the wisdom of his acquisitions. "Michael Cohen has a great insight into the real estate market," he told the New York Post. "He has invested in my buildings because he likes to make money, and he does." Indeed, Trump was so impressed by Cohen's insight that by May, he hired Cohen as an executive vice president at the Trump Organization, the same title held by three of Trump's children, Donald Jr., Ivanka, and Eric. Now, Cohen was working in the same building as his old buddy, Felix Sater. Once Cohen began working for Trump, his pronouncements only enhanced